I'm Leland Elhard. I teach at the Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Right now it's called the Lutheran Theological Seminary. In September it'll be called Trinity Lutheran Seminary, because our seminary is the one that's merging with or consolidating with HAMA Seminary in Springfield, Ohio. I don't like to lecture, but I end up doing a lot of it anyway, because it always turns out, as far as I'm concerned, that I'm saying the best things in the room. So I have to say it. We'll try to work on that, because I really do discover that people learn more. Teach me a few things once in a while when they talk to each other, and you know, and in a large group. Just check it out sometime when you've been to a session, something like this, and you try to remember what you learned in it 5 days later. You probably will remember the things that you said much more than anything that anybody else said. And so we try to figure out some way of you saying it. If I need a theme for a lot of the things I'll be doing around here, it could be from Ecclesiastes 12, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the time of trouble comes and the years draw nigh when you will say, I see no purpose in them. And maybe the one about there's a time for this and a time for that, from Ecclesiastes 3. I teach it both in the areas of pastoral care and systematic theology. And my concept of systematic theology is one which finds its power in that it helps us understand our experience individually and together much more powerfully than in any other way, finally, of getting at what human experience is about. So eventually we get to some theological themes in these things. Sometimes we don't see it building up to that, and sometimes we do. And my concept of theology is that, again, all of us are theologians and all of us work together in doing theology. By focusing on things like our being middle-aged, or the fact that sometimes people are middle-aged, you lay yourself open immediately to the charge that you're doing navel-gazing. And that really is terrible. Nothing to do with the fact that maybe the motivation behind a lot of the stuff that Dr. Jorstad was talking about last hour maybe has something to do with people having to deal with the middle age crisis, but they can't deal with it directly, so they go around barn with it, with some of the movements they get involved with. It's hard to look the truth in the face of especially when it's the truth about us and what we really live with in our insides all the time. So maybe there's a contribution for this way of going at things. I'm aware, say from the Titus passage that we had on Christmas night, on Tuesday, and from other places in the Bible, that the Bible is aware that people are in various stages of life. There are young men and old men and young women and old women, and there's something different that seems to be going on for them. We can go into quote other sources. Shakespeare writes a famous passage about human development where he goes through all the stages of life. Dante wrote a famous thing somewhere in this midlife crisis that goes something like, this, in the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. Ah, how hard it is to tell of that wood, savage and harsh and dense, the thought of which renews my fear. So bitter is it that death is hardly more. Dante experienced, wrote these words in his 42nd year. He had been experiencing them in his own life since age 37. These are from the opening stanzas of the Divine Comedy. Carl Jung wrote some famous words in a book he wrote in the 1930s, famous because I guess I've seen him quoted in about 1,000 books now. He says that in the patients that he has had over age 35, that every last one of them, except maybe one or two, nearly every last one of them has to deal with the religious issues of life, and that's the reason why he or she is sick. Sigmund Freud, there are others like Darwin and so on who taught us that there's some sort of developmental process in existence, in human existence. But Sigmund Freud gave it a big shove by delineating about three or four stages which go up until about age 10 or so. It was people like Erik Erikson, and a neo-Freudian, who, along with others like Havik Hurst at Chicago and so on, who suggested that there are developmental crises all of our days, and suggested that the adult has about four crises: identity versus identity confusion, which is sort of the beginning of adulthood to deal with that one. Then intimacy versus isolation. Then generativity versus stagnation as the crisis for middle age. And then the one that wraps it all up in old age, integrity versus despair. I'm not going to do very much with Erikson this time, except to say that I drew out the whole set of crises of human development as Erikson sees them and put them on the board there. I put them on the board in this way to say that if you want to be true to the Ericksonian model of the human being, you see the human being as being a set of these eight crises, always. Always. But as we go through the life cycle, one of these becomes the center, so to speak, of the whole mess. And it's always a crisis. To be human is to be in crisis. To be alive psychologically, Erikson says, you are constantly resolving psychological crises. You'd also see them tied into social and political and economic crises as well, and physiological crises also. But to be a human being is always to be resolving these crises of the ego. The ego is defined by Erikson as that central focusing process at the center of all the life processes that we are as human beings. The one that focuses our life in roughly the big area of middle age is generativity versus stagnation. Generativity, the capacity dealing with the capacity to care, dealing with the fact that we've generated all this stuff out of our identity and intimacy, out of all the powers that we've matched up with other people. We've generated all this. Now what are we going to do with it? How do we teach it? How do we take care of that which is in the world that somehow or other we have been placed in charge of, and we find ourselves being in charge of it? Our parents die. Margaret Mead points out that it's in kind of unique in our generation that our parents die when we're in our 30s and our 40s, and we find ourselves being at the top of the heap. This didn't happen in other generations. They were gone before this time. So that's a part of the middle age crisis. I'll leave Erickson at this point. If people want me to do it, I can either do one lecture on Erickson or 10 of them without looking at a note. And if in the couple of weeks ahead there's some interest in that, there may be some more none of that relating human development and faith. So going back to the Middle Age crisis, the newer stuff has been done by people like Levinson, Gould, and Gail Sheehy. A few years ago, Gail Sheehy, who was a reporter, was in Northern Ireland, and she was interviewing a young man, and as she was asking him a question, a bullet came from somewhere and blew his face off. This bothered her a little bit. In fact, it drove her into the very center of a terrific midlife crisis. She was around 35 at the time, I guess. And as part of her working through what this was all about, she decided to write, to study it in depth with all the resources she could find. She read Erickson and Levinson and Gould and others, and then interviewed 115 couples who were roughly in the Middle Age time, seeking to confirm or disconfirm or add flesh and blood to the theories of these scholars. This summer, a few weeks before I came here, I read Levinson's book called The Seasons of Life, on which a lot of Gail Sheehy's book Passages is built on. By the way, Passages says number one from coast to coast at the top of it. I guess it's sold, it's one of these books that's made money, and people are reading it all over the place. You can judge whether a middle-aged person is with it these days by asking them whether or not they've read Passages. I read Levinson's book called The Seasons of a Man's Life, based on his several years' study of 40 men. And they were writers and biologists and executives, and he did manage to get in 10 working class folks. I resisted learning anything from the book throughout it, and the particular images that he came up with, because I didn't like his sample. Found that the rather sharp delineating of when people might be going through a particular stage of middle age didn't seem to work for me. I reread a little bit of Sheehy, and I've thought a little bit more about it, and the people are coming up with something that suggests that they're onto something, and maybe we'll fuss with it as a group a little bit. There seems to be there's a dual side to this, as with many things. The middle age crisis relates to jobs, tasks, events that we have to do or put up with, we are pushed into various crises in our life. But the other part of it that comes from Erickson and Freud and all the people who think there is such a thing as psychological reality inside us, say that there's an inner set of things, an inner process that's wants to get done, has to get done, will get done somehow or other. If we don't get it done now, we'll get it later. If it isn't done in one way, it'll get done another way. The mid-age stuff has to do with this combination of what's inside and outside. And as you look at, as you start to tell stories, your own and other people's, you begin to see the two sides of it. And maybe I can tell a couple of stories here. First is that of Mary, whom I knew for about a year, about 4 years ago. She was a member of one of our Lutheran churches in the Midwest. She was had developed a kind of identity as the nice crazy person of the congregation. She didn't like that identity and was thinking of leaving the place. But when she heard me preach my first sermon, when I was doing a little visiting kind of thing at that congregation for about a year, and she heard my first sermon, she decided to stay around. And the thing that she kept coming back to that I had said in that first sermon was that it was all right for Christians to be kind of half-baked. So she said, okay, I guess I can stay around here for a while, because that's me. Her story, little by little, came out. And she sort of, for a couple of years, had made trips between the psychiatrist's chair, and including a stay at a state hospital, and the charismatic movement. The story is that when she was in her adolescence, in high school, she was had the best grades in her high school. And had lots of talents that she sort of had a feeling were there and wanted to develop and make something of. Her father was a semi-benevolent tyrant, some of you have heard of these before, knew what place in life a woman had, and that was to be subservient to a man, first the father and then the husband. About the time that she finished high school, her father said, now it's time for you to get married. I've been taking care of you and protecting you up until now. Somewhere along the line, she sort of met a guy with similar traits to the father, and the father simply turned her over to him. And all her wants for being in college, for figuring out who she was, what she could do in the world, as at least some of us in our culture, many of them men, have a chance at, never were realized. Within a year, she was a mother, and she was a mother four or five times over during the next 20 years. About the time that her oldest son was strong enough to fight back and not take what his father had in mind for him, and the family started to come apart around that crisis, she started to come apart. And that's when the struggle was going on. And while I was around that year, it was interesting to see how she got little from the congregation, which is really a very caring, accepting, marvelous congregation. She got some courage to get in touch with what she had been looking for, wanting to try to do for all her life. Showed in lots of ways that this woman was loaded with possibilities, with potentialities, and was able to make them come alive for other people. And she got healthier along the way. Obviously, this was causing quite a problem for her husband, who a very devout Lutheran member of the congregation, who who just couldn't figure out what to do with this package of dynamite that he had been able to package all these years and was no longer able to do. So she was, everybody in that group was going through some sort of midlife crisis. Another passage from Gail Sheehy that describes sort of a combination of inner and outer, and maybe this is a little bit more of the outer stuff. For the 15 years of her marriage, Doris's husband had never pressed her to entertain or go with him to business affairs. One night he came home with the news that he is being considered by his firm's major competitor for its top spot. And listen to this. The retiring president has invited both of us to a dinner party next week. This will clinch it. Oh my God, Doris said. I haven't had dinner with anybody above waist height for years. What'll I talk about? Come on, honey, her husband said. All you have to do is glance through last week's newspapers. Dutifully, Doris read 4 weeks back issues of the news of the week in review, and every night before she went to sleep, she memorized the name of another Arab leader. The party was studded with the worldly and the wise. Her dinner partner was the company head. Oh no, she thought. But valiantly she plunged in and began expounding on the problem of air rights when cities start using solar energy. The man's mouth was full, so she went on to explain Hubert Humphrey's philosophy of democracy for the Third World. Taking a breath, she noticed to her delight that she had the full and transfixed attention of all the dinner guests at her end of the table. Encouraged, she ad-libbed for five more minutes. The president was obviously impressed. In fact, he couldn't take his eyes off her. She looked on modestly and discovered that all the while, out of habit, she had been cutting up the man's steak.
It can't be true.
I'm going to go back to some of a little bit of the theories. Generativity versus stagnation. Erickson's point in his generativity stuff is that we are meant by our whole social cultural history from the very beginning of human evolution to be caretakers at this stage of life. To be the power folks, to be at the center, scary as that is, awful as it is, that we are meant to produce, to generate, that is, to bring forth and to take care of the world, to have dominion. That word from Genesis. And if that dominion is not something that we can handle, the resources of our life, our social context does not encourage us, affirm us, lead us to being able to do that in some way or other, exercise our gifts in some way or other, we will be we'll go into the negative side of it. And the negative side of it has something to do with stagnation. That we turn in upon ourselves, to take care of ourselves, literally get stuck, be a pool that turns rancid and smelly rather than flowing out into life and nurturing and watering the world. We see it sometimes, I think, in people who in the early days can't or decide not to have children and then discover that they really want to do that very much and are desperate to do it. But there are many ways of realizing generativity. so you don't, or choose not to have children, maybe you end up being somebody who teaches children. Or you take care, you work out ways of taking care of the world so that children have a better chance in the next, in their time. Erikson is very strong about this. He thinks it goes way down deep into our physiology. I don't know if I agree with him, but he wonders about people who, with the development of contraceptive technology today, who can avoid accidents, never have children, and Erikson says they can play with the fire of creation, but never actually do it. And he wonders what kind of psychosomatic illnesses of all sorts may result from that. There's a strong conservative streak in Erik Erikson. He sounds like all the people who say the main thing you're doing when you're getting married is getting ready to be parents. Now I want to add into this mix from Erikson and so on the summary of what Levinson at Harvard and Yale and Gould and on the West Coast, I guess at UCLA, have been coming up with as far as imaging of the various images of going through middle age might be. Early adulthood, the mastery of intimacy, 20 to 30. The time of life when spouses are wooed and wed, and when adolescent friendships are cast off if they no longer seem desirable or consolidated, if they seem worthy of future investment. Dr. Valiant says of the many study that no sooner did they win autonomy from parents than they learned how to entrust themselves to others. Levinson calls a part of this period getting into the adult world. And certainly young adults do not quite feel a part of the grown-up life of responsibility and duty. They must get into it, must learn its rules and experiment with adult roles. While some of them choose and start on careers, it is usually with only a modicum of commitment. Others delay, devoting themselves first to sexual and social goals. Many have children now and are intensely absorbed in parenting. Roger Gould finds this period of life a relatively calm one, at least until young adults reach their late 20s. Extreme emotions are guarded against. The emphasis is on modulating the emotional tone in an experimental effort to learn the proper tone for adult life. So you manage to get through that awful period called adolescence, and you end up with probably married or having made some preliminary commitment not to be. And you get into that career, maybe, for most people they do, and everybody, all the big shots are sort of watching you to see if you're going to be somebody worth keeping around in the company or not, so you work your head off, or really act like you are, and you do some of the same stuff with your family. And you don't think that much about it during your 20s. You're going to live forever. You're strong as a bull. There's nothing you can't do. Wow. Early adulthood, transition or crisis, around 30. Once marriage and career lines have been established, young adults frequently enter a turbulent period marked by questioning of values and commitments. Around 30, young married men and women may first consider and even have extramarital affairs. The men may switch careers and the women become more serious about having one. The focus of the early years is gone, and the direction of the next decade unclear. Gould says the trouble lies in the fact that at this point young adults feel that some inner aspect is striving to be accounted for. Levinson finds that men around 30 question their career lines because they feel their occupational choice is too constraining or is a violation or betrayal of a dream they now had to pursue. Similarly, men whose lives in their 20s were unstable and unconstrained may now feel a need for order and responsibility. This brief transitional period, says Levinson, may occasion considerable inner turmoil, depression, confusion, struggle with the environment and within oneself, or it may involve a more quiet reassessment and intensification of effort. I think I'll read a letter from to Ann Landers. Dear Ann Landers, I'm a married woman in my early 30s who is puzzled and searching for answers that might not exist. Every now and then I get word that friends of ours, couples who've been married for 25 years and longer, are getting a divorce. I harbor a secret fear in the corner of my heart that one day that older couple might be us. Tammy and I have gotten along well. We have four lively kids. I've made it a point to teach our children that Daddy comes first. He is king in our house. They love and respect him. He is a wonderful father. But there must be more to life than PTA, housework, marketing, cooking, cleaning, laundry, and loving your husband. I ache to feel that special electricity when my eyes meet his across a crowded room. It never happens. I yearn for a man who will make my heart pound a mile a minute. Timmy used to, but the thrill is gone. Things are quiet and calm, and I might as well say it, dull as dishwater. We have a lot to be thankful. Good health, attractive, well-behaved kids, and a promising financial future. Why isn't this enough? Is something wrong with me? Am I chasing the impossible dream? I will be watching and waiting for your answer. Please don't fail me. Moon glow. Dear moon. Put away your storybooks, little girl. You've got some growing up to do. Yes, there's more to life than PTA, housework, cooking, cleaning, laundry, and loving your husband. There's illness and emotional breakdowns that make it impossible for some women to do the housework, cooking, cleaning, and laundry. As for loving your husband, don't knock it, honey. There are plenty of husbands who aren't interested. There's also alcoholism, in-law trouble, problems with out-of-control children, and money worries. Read the papers. Look around you. Case your friends. No marriage can maintain the honeymoon level of excitement forever, and it's a good thing. We'd all die of exhaustion. Time diminishes the raging fires to a soft glow, present but no longer ferocious and demanding. Count your blessings. Too many people fail to appreciate what they have until they've lost it. Don't let it happen to you. So, the chief lawgiver and wisdom person in our culture? If the law can work, Ann Landers ought to be Jesus Christ. So around 30 comes this wondering, first sort of wondering, what did I get into? I feel kind of cramped. There are things in me that are laying fallow over here, and there's sort of a sense that there might come to an end to all this, but not too big yet. Intermediate adulthood. Now, this is when I, putting all these stages together is what I have struggled with, and I ask you to struggle with me. The mastery of careers, 30 to 40. So they've gone through this transitional period in one way or another. Decided to stay married and love Timmy or go out and be with Ralph. I don't know. The transitional period behind them, men and women now begin to make a strong commitment to accomplishments outside the personal. Levinson calls this period settling down. People in their 30s seem to want stability, a niche in society, and they also want to make it, to move forward to major occupational goals. The Ivy League men whom Valiant studied were at this time in their lives very outer-directed and not introspective. They tended to sacrifice playing and instead worked hard to become specialists. Rather than question whether they had married the right woman, rather than dream of other careers, They changed their baby's diapers and looked over their shoulders at the competition. In their later 30s, men in particular are involved in what Levinson calls boom, becoming one's own man. A curious phenomenon of this urge towards selfhood is that people now begin to pull away from and even turn against formerly cherished mentors. This is one thing that the research did turn up, that a person tended to come up with a mentor in your 20s or so, early 30s, and let that teacher, that master, sort of be your guide for quite a number of years until this boom stuff. The phenomenon has been chiefly documented in men, but at Yale has begun to be studied in the lives of professional women as well. The mentor, usually 10 to 15 years older than the late 30s individual, once served as a benevolent guide to the depths and shallows of a profession. But in the course of becoming one's own man or woman, a late 30s striver must abandon or at least separate from the mentor. So on. By 39, the decks are clear and men, most lifespan studies have followed them, begin to focus on key events in their careers, something through which the world will signal whether or not they are valued. It may be the promotion to a new job, reception of a new book, acceptance of a piece of research. This signal takes time to receive, so that late 30s men often seem to be waiting, suspended. Intermediate or midlife transition or crisis, around 40. Slowly, inexorably, whatever the outcome of the awaited event, the midlife crisis now begins. The man around 40 may have attained his life's dream, the critics may have lauded his novel, and the National Institutes of Health may have granted him bountiful research funds, but still he is thrown into a state of bemused or even rageful introspection. Men at this age feel their achievements are hollow, their bodies are declining, and they hear death whispering to them for the first time in their lives. It is at this time that many men translate their angst into action. They divorce, take a trip to Europe, change the direction of their research or their style of writing. Even when they don't make such dramatic changes, when the externals of their lives show no such extreme variation, the men themselves are somewhat different. Having held onto their life structures, their personalities change. Is the crisis harmful as well as painful? Levinson believes it often enriches and strengthens men for later years. He himself at age 46 changed the direction of his research entirely and left Harvard for Yale, and so on and so on. Points to other people like Freud, Gandhi, Frank Lloyd Wright, who had crisis at this time. Many men who don't have a crisis at 40 become terribly weighed down and lose the vitality they need to continue developing in the rest of the adulthood stages. Middle adulthood, reorganization and renaissance, 40 to 50. For most men, and perhaps, but we do not know yet, most women, the midlife crisis reaches its peak sometimes in the early 40s, so that the period which follows is relatively calm. Levinson calls it a time of re-civilization. Gould, one in which there's a relief from the internal tearing apart of the immediate previous years. Men and women in their 40s display a more stable loyalty to their mates. They very actively look for sympathy and affection from their spouses, who in many ways they seem to be dependent on in a mode similar to that of their former dependency on parents. They've just probably lost their parents, so now they have to turn to friend spouse. But Valiant points out that this period is not altogether an untroubled one. For men at least, it is often marked by depression and renewed questioning of the meaning of life and work. Still, he suggests that despite an increased awareness of unhappiness, the man in middle adulthood is nevertheless calm, even though men in their 40s are conscious of more depression. They are also in midlife appeared far more able to accept their own tragedy and that of others. So we've gone through early adulthood, 20 to 30, mastery of intimacy, and we had a transition around 30, wondering what that is all about. Intermediate adulthood, the mastery of careers, 30 to 40, then another transition crisis around 40, and then moving on to middle adulthood, reorganization and renaissance, 40 to 50. Then the last stage of middle age is called later adulthood, increased awareness of mortality. Gould calls this a period of mellowing and warming up. Men and women are truly adults now, truly adults now, for they no longer see their parents as the cause of their life problems, nor view their spouses as controlling them, and thus resembling parents. According to Gould, the children's lives are now seen as potential sources of warm comfort and satisfaction. The spouse is now seen as a valuable source of companionship in life. There is, of course, an increased awareness of mortality. And this may make men and women in later adulthood seem petty, become focused on their health or their anxieties, or yet again express doubts about the value of their contributions to the world. But curiously, according to Gould, this is not a time of diminishing interest in human contact. Rather, it is a period of life in which there is a hunger for personal relationships. John A.B. McLeish, an eminent Canadian educator, has documented this in a recent book, The Elysian Adult, Creativity in the Middle and Late Years, and indicated the remarkable personal and professional accomplishment of many people in late adulthood. I want you now to, as I read things, fuss with your own history, with things that have happened to you, with things that have been sparked by what I've shared with you thus far, and see if you can come up with an image or two of middle age. One that, it need not be the only one you think of, maybe you think of 25, but think of one that's kind of got some truth to it. Maybe it's not at the top of the heap, but one that helps you cope with yourself, with your story, and one that you might want to share with the rest of us after a little while. I'm just going to read some things from various sources, a lot of poetry, some things I collected some years ago. About five or six or seven years ago, I just before New Year's Day, I put together a collection of tapes of music, a tape made up of music and readings of various kind from various sources. I called it "Nostalgia Isn't What It Used to Be," and one of the things I quoted is a Peanuts cartoon, Charlie Brown speaking with Lucy. "You're going to be proud of me, Lucy. I've decided that this next year is going to be my year of decision. This is a list of things in my life that I'm going to correct. I'm going to be a better person." Lucy, not me. "I'm going to spend this whole year regretting the past." "It's the only way, Charlie Brown. I'm going to cry over spilt milk and sigh over lost loves. It's a lot easier. It's too hard to improve. I've tried it once. It drove me crazy. Forget the future is my motto. Regret the past. Oh, how I regret the past. Why did I do this? Why did I do that? Why? I regret it all. Oh, what regrets, what remorse, what anguish." Charlie Brown, sigh. From Death of a Man by Lael Wurtenbaker. I am reminded of one of those high moments in the New York theater. In S.N. Behrman's adaptation of Girodot's Amphitryon 38, Jupiter, the immortal god, takes on the disguise of Amphitryon's mortal flesh in order to make love to Amphitryon's mortal and faithful wife. Anybody who's seen a movie called is this the movie out on the same theme? Roughly. But anyway, the god takes the flesh of this beautiful woman's husband to make love to her. And then suddenly Jupiter says afterward, to his fellow god, Mercury. She will use little expressions, this god dealing with this human being. She will use little expressions, and that widens the abyss between us. What expressions, asks Mercury. Alfred Lunt, acting Jupiter, read the lines so tenderly, they still echo in my memory. She will say, when I was a child, or when I'm old, or never in all my life. This stabs me, Mercury. Then Jupiter says of the gods, but we miss something, Mercury. The poignance of the transient, the intimation of mortality, that sweet sadness of grasping at something you cannot hold. Why are the things that have no death the ones with neither sight nor breath? Eternity is thrust upon a bit of earth, a senseless stone, a grain of dust, a casual clod, receives the greatest gift of God. A pebble in the roadway lies. It never dies. The grass our fathers cut away is growing on their graves today. The tiniest brooks that scarcely flow eternally will come and go. There is no kind of death to kill the sands that lie so meek and still. But man is great and strong and wise, and so he dies. Peter, Paul, and Mary sing. This house goes on sale every Wednesday morning and taken off the market in the afternoon. You can buy a piece of it if you want to. It's been good to me if it's been good for you. Take the grand look now. The fire is burning. Is that your reflection on the wall? I can show you this room and some others if you come to see the house at all. Careful, up the stairs, a few are missing. I haven't had the chance to make repairs. The first step is the hardest one to master. The last one, I'm not really sure, is there. This room here once heard childish laughter, and I come back to hear it now and again. I can't say that I'm certain what you're after, but in this room, a part of you will remain. The second floor, the lady sleeps in waiting, past the lantern, tiptoe in its glance. In the room, the soft brown arms of shadow. This room, the hardest one to pass. How much will you pay to live in the attic? The shavings off your mind are the only rent. I left some wood there, if you wouldn't. That's a difficult line. I left some wood there if you thought you couldn't, or if the shouldn't that you bought has been spent. This house goes on sale every Wednesday morning and taken off the market in the afternoon. I can buy a piece of it if you want to. It's been good for me if it's been good for you. Sometime I might read, it's a long piece, by from Hal Boyle, philosophers are made, not born. The Country Beautiful puts, believe it or not, has put together a collection of pieces on the human story that just never quits. From Sarah Teasdale, I must have passed the crest a while ago, and now I'm going down. Strange to have crossed the crest and not to know. But the brambles were always catching the hem of my gown. All the morning I thought how proud I should be to stand there straight as a queen, wrapped in the wind and the sun, with the world around me, but the air was dull. There was little I could have seen. It is nearly level along the beaten track, and the brambles caught in my gown. It's no use now to think of turning back. The rest of the way will only be going down. Grow up as soon as you can. It pays. The only time you really live fully is from 30 to 60. The young men are young men. The young are slaves to dream. The old, servants of regrets. Only the middle-aged have all their five senses in the keeping of their wits. Now, uniquely, man can see the whole of life's time while still in its midst, looking back as he could not do when he was young, and forward as he will not do when very old. His perspective is 360 degrees. It enables the discovery of the optimum use of time. It is a maxim of me to be as young as one can. There is nothing can pay one for that invaluable ignorance which is the companion of youth, those sanguine, groundless hopes, and that lively vanity which make all the happiness of life. To my extreme mortification, I grow wiser every day. A man who at 20 is a young Lothario, for example, and at 30 a dashing young man about town, at 40 becomes, without having changed his personality or habits one iota, a roué who very soon will qualify for the ultimate distinction of being a dirty old man. Well, who wants to be young anyhow? Any idiot born in the last 40 years can be young. Besides, 45 isn't really old. It's right on the border. At least, unless the elevator's out of order. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love illusions, I recall. I really don't love it, no love at all. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads, they say I've changed. But something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions, I recall. I really don't know life at all. Four more, and then we'll see what you've been thinking for a few minutes. We stand for a moment like those who pause upon a mountain path and gaze downward to the valley they have left below and upward to the heights that allure to further effort. We have been brought to our present point by powers we know not of, but whether our feet shall ever stand upon those high and lonely levels depends upon ourselves. We are like voyagers when the harbor dangers have been safely passed, the pilot dropped, and the ship heads out to sea. From now on, the voyage is our own. Ours the task of making it a joy. Ours to prepare to weather the unfeeling destructive storm. Ours to find in the pageantry of nature and in comradeship with our fellows a sufficient inspiration. It is when his mental powers are already beginning to decline that a man is capable of the greatest works. Just as it is hotter in July and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the sun has turned and is on a downward grade than it is in June at midday. At 50, a man's real life begins. He has acquired upon which to achieve, receive from which to give, learn from which to teach, and cleared upon which to build. We are, God help us, mature women in a world measured by a teenager's waist. One more. With steady foot and even pace, I tread the Milky Way. I've youth without its levity, and age without decay. This is taking longer than I wished it to be, but I just wanted to show the village that I have as much stuff that I can preach at people as anybody else. For 2 minutes, what are images of middle age that seem important to you? I've laid literally hundreds on you here. But which ones hit you?
I don't know if you mean by image, but I think that kind of self-examination, looking back.
What's a picture of what middle age is? What story are you living, being a middle ager? And maybe some people here who aren't middle-aged, there aren't very many middle-aged people here. There are a lot of people younger than that. But from observing middle-aged people, what seems to be images that they're living?
Well, I'll just take a shot in the dark, but I think the fulfillment of middle age, as you've described and so forth, is so dependent on our 20s. And perhaps the, let's say, by the blessing of God, the opportunity to avoid some of the catastrophes that perhaps have destroyed the later years of so many other people that I think probably, although it wasn't mentioned directly in many of these quotations by Shakespeare or the others, that the partnership with God as you went along day by day is what gives you the satisfaction and the joy in the 40s to 50s to 60s that make life really valuable to you and perhaps to those around you.
So I hear you saying something around an image of luck. Somehow or other we got through it. Grace. I'm discovering through what life has been for me thus far that God has been with me and is in the middle of this adventure.
I think what comes through to me perhaps is that one of those last things you read about
the heart.
One of the things that comes through to me was based on one of the last things that was read, having to do with now assuming the responsibility which before has been, well, if not directly, at least indirectly, a result of one's launching from a home, from a school, from the influences which carry through for a number of years after you actually leave that particular place.
You finally figured out what your ship is and found yourself steering it. Well, let's stop. I think maybe you'll have maybe if it's been any good, you'll have some inner dialogue and maybe talk with somebody else. Tomorrow I'm going to do images of aging, old age. If you might be back tomorrow, I'd like you to take some homework to get ready for it. It's a paper called Concepts and Issues in Aging. I'd like you to, if you want it, there it is. Bring it back. If you're not coming back, I'll let you decide whether you want to take a copy of that along. I brought 200 with me. And I may run out. I would hope that you would read it and bring it back, whether you come back for the discussion tomorrow or not on it. I'd like to base a lot of what we do tomorrow on your reflections of what you read here, for those of you who had a chance to be here and to read it. If you find in it some things that you really want to keep, take the thing with you. But I'm dealing with the problem of doing this at least two or three times during the next 2 weeks and not running out of these. So that's all for now.